It is Saturday, April 4th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, after Geek News, we'll be talking about video visual effects. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today, in the Arum, we will be joined by Mark Christensen, artist, animator, and author of many books, including his recently released After Effects, CS4, Visual Effects and Compositing. In the second half, we'll invite you to join us with questions and comments about video work and film work. You can join us during the show on our public Geek Chat. Just go to the geekspeak.org website, geekspeak.org, and choose today's show, and then on the left-hand side, just click on the Geek Chat. Beginning Monday, April 6th on KOSP, the first hour of the Deanne Rain Show will air at noon. News Hour from BBC will follow at 1, and then the second hour of the Deanne Rain Show will be on at 2. That's Deanne Rain's News Hour and the Deanne Rain Hour 2, weekdays noon to 3, beginning April 6th on KOSP. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Al Luckow, he is a new media architect. Morning, Al.
Good morning.
It's like you asked me if the mic worked beforehand. And so
yeah,
of course it didn't.
Just to make sure. Yeah.
See it.
And, hey, Miles, I can make mistakes, too. You did
yeah,
great
I was about
weekend.
To say, it wasn't just me.
Miles Elam, student programmer, political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Speaking of mistakes, not just little tiny technical things, which are fine, but last week we have some corrections.
Right, we have a correction, and it was a tiny technical thing. Thank you very much. We're talking about the top-level domain .ch. I had erroneously stated that would be Czech Republic, and that is, in fact, Switzerland.
Why is CS or CZ or CS?
CH.
CH. Why is CH Switzerland?
Quit asking silly questions.
It
just is.
Check on that Swiss.
It's spelled with a CH, didn't you know?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Thank you, Miles, for the correction, and thank you for covering for last week. I really appreciate it. It was a good show, you guys. We also have Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. And Ben, and you've actually set up our guest today, which is very exciting.
Indeed,
all about
yeah,
After Effects,
fun.
Kind of your thing. Well, let's get started with the geek news, and I think I'm going to start with Al. Hi.
Howdy.
So what's up with, what's creepy in the world right now?
Well, let's see. I think we'll think about robots again. A lot of people out there really enjoy robots. Let's talk about that. There's a robot now there that is actually doing research on its own. It's part of my thought that robots are going to take over the world.
Wait, like it's sitting at a library doing
research?
Yes.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's at Aberystwyth University in the UK. And they have developed a robot to do scientific research, and it's already identified the role of several genes in yeast cells and is able to plan further experiments to test its own hypothesis.
So it's a scientist.
It's a scientist, and it's already doing research, and it's just a matter of time before it figures out our biggest flaws and finds a way to exterminate the human race. But it's working, and these things, the robot can just continue to work all the time. It doesn't complain. You just sit it there. What they're actually saying is that these robots are going to be doing boring work that humans don't really want to do. It's, a lot of research is just test this, right. and apparently they're doing it. So, hey, it's just part of this robot thing, but I'm not really done talking about robots yet.
Okay.
There's a, Honda. If you guys ever seen that robot, I think it's called Aikibo.
Yeah, the little white one that dances around and, and seems kind of human-like.
Well, that's from Japan's Honda Research Institute. And they have got this thing now so that you can put a helmet on and it reads your brain waves and you can control the robot through your brain waves.
Does it work?
I've seen a YouTube video of it. Pretty much they've got the robot raising his hand up and lowering it.
That's is the human doing the same thing, or is the human just thinking?
No, the human is a guy that's got a helmet on, sitting in a chair with his eyes closed, wearing those plastic Crocs. And he's
plastic what?
Those little plastic shoes that
yeah.
people.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Anyway, he's sitting there and he is just thinking about raising his arm, and then they've got the robot. Okay, you know, so granted, it's not really,
but it's as creepy as it sounds.
Well, it's just a matter of time before there's a software glitch and the helmet malfunctions and the robot starts controlling the man. I mean, it's just a question of time.
and sci-fi authors helping.
Can these robots build more of themselves?
Not yet. Well, if he thinks
how
about
do you
it,
know?
If this Honda robot gets in touch with this research robot. Somehow.
Okay, the thing is, they don't need us, right?
Or they don't need us.
There's no reason for needing us.
No. They can raise and lower their hands now. They can do research.
Okay, but in the Matrix, you kind of had that, right? But the humans were actually batteries for people. I mean, we're not getting near that.
Oh, right? Well, okay. Yes, we are. Okay. and it depends on how you think about it, okay? It's in the same vein. The story can be scary or it can be really exciting, depending on the way that you put it.
Do it exciting.
Okay. Yeast cells using glucose in human blood might one day power implants such as pacemakers.
So we're talking about like a fuel cell. You put it next to the pacemaker. You have some wires connected it. Yeah. And now the pacemaker never runs out of juice or anything. Your blood gets used a little bit, kind of like your blood gets used in your muscles.
Right.
That's great. Perfect. Yeah. What's the scary version?
You could say, yeast-powered fuel cell feeds on human blood.
That is scarier.
Yep.
Thank you for
that. It's a team at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And they've created a tiny microbial fuel cell by encapsulating yeast cells in a flexible capsule.
Mm-hmm. We should have suspected it was the Canadians.
They're always doing these kind of things. And it's a living source of power, and it could charge batteries of a device that's in you.
How much power are we talking about? Like a micro?
Well, the yeast-based fuel cell produces around 40 nanowatts of power.
Oh, that's not very much.
Well, it's something. Yeah. A wristwatch uses
a nanowatt is 1/1000th of a milliwatt.
We'll go with that.
Yeah.
And a milliwatt is 1/1000th of a watt.
Yeah.
It's just enough to charge things. And if they use a capacitor with it, there's a way that they can kind of store the energy.
Well, what is like a wristwatch run on?
A microwatt is a typical wristwatch battery might produce a microwatt.
All right. So it's a ways to go. But you could theoretically put a whole bunch of these in.
And they could genetically modify the yeast cells to boost the power output.
Right.
But overall.
I've heard really interesting stuff about the cells that produce the electric charge in electric eel. Mm. And that those and getting the genome from that might be useful in similar type of research.
Well, you know, we have robots doing their own thinking. You know, potential of controlling humans, and now they can feed off our own blood.
That's perfect.
Okay.
I know someone's going to jump on us about this, so I have to get the units correct.
Thank you so much. Okay. When you said, is that what it is? I'm like, oh, go ahead.
So there are 1,000 microwatts in a single milliwatt, and there are 1,000 nanowatts in a microwatt. So
it's depressing.
So 1 milliwatt is 1 million nanowatts.
Right. Okay. It's pretty small.
So it's a very small.
But it's something.
But if a watch runs on, what, you say 20 microwatts?
They say compared to the microwatt, a typical wristwatch battery might produce.
Right.
So I guess it's 1 microwatt is what, you know, it's typically, I mean, it depends on, if you have the watch that has a calculator and it uses more power probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
and just to round things off, a milliwatt is 1/1000th of a watt. So
right, thanks.
Miles is a little touchy on these.
Well, we had mistakes.
Yeah, we had mistakes. All right, we had the Greek versus Roman gods issue.
Did you correct that last week? You
know what? No, I didn't.
Okay, really clearly, we understand the planets are named after Roman gods. Sorry, we said Greek gods.
Oh, I thought it was Greek gods.
Don't do that.
I'm kidding. One of the gods actually called us.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's
it.
It was Pluto.
No, we'd make another mistake. It was Mount Olympus. No, that's
you're
Greek.
Not a god. No, I'm a god.
Pluto was angry.
All right.
Thank goodness Pluto is friends in Illinois.
Let's go on with the next news story. Other than robots, let's talk about servers. Ben, Google?
Yeah, so Google actually has all this time been keeping their server design under wraps because they build their own servers instead of buying them from companies who build servers.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out, recently they gave a tour of one of their data centers and they showed us pictures of one of their servers. And they have a couple interesting little surprises. The biggest one was
human bodies with powers.
Yes,
power cells.
Yes, actually, they hire interns. You see, and they put them in these data centers.
Do not do evil is actually totally false.
Well, interns don't fall into the it's
go
a
on.
Classification issue. No,
many companies don't consider interns to be people. So
yeah, it's true.
What are they doing that's unique?
Interesting. Each server has its own 12-volt battery. In case of power failure. And normally what companies will do is they'll have these gigantic, huge batteries called UPSs, which will, if the power dies, then the UPSs will power however many servers. They're these huge batteries. Turns out they found that they could actually do it with a 12-volt battery for each
like
of these servers.
Battery.
Yeah, no, what?
Like a car battery?
Yeah.
Okay.
And these servers would run off of that if it died. And it's way, way cheaper doing it that way than doing it with UPSs.
Right, because car batteries are cheap. Right.
Yeah, they also...
power supply that comes with the machine can trickle charge it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's what I actually wanted to do for my my home stereo unit. It's actually a car stereo, and I'm always running a power supply for it, and the power supply is kind of loud. But also, whenever you turn the power supply off, there's no trickle charge for the car radio, which is installed in the wall, and so the loses the clock. And so I thought, I could put a battery, like a car battery, in the closet mm-hmm. where the stuff is. The only thing you see in my house is actually just the face of a car radio on a wall. But Dari didn't want me to have a car battery in the closet, so I didn't do it. Anyway, it's a good solution.
They also revealed that they have 1,160 servers in these cargo containers each, mm-hmm. and they have several of these cargo containers. And they're not the only company that's done that. Sun has been marketing this for a while now, but it's interesting to see that Google is taking that same approach of having these mobile units with a power consumption. Each cargo unit has consumes approximately or up to 250 kilowatts.
Now, so, how many nanowatts is that?
Let's see. Well, there are 1,000 watts.
No,
wait,
I'm
going to get it wrong. Miles, yeah, Miles, you tell us.
Right.
No. With the whole 12-volt battery thing, they found that they said that UPSs can reach 92 to 95% efficiency. They can do 99% efficiency with these batteries.
Hmm.
So that at least that's what they're claiming. So. So
and
that's,
for the record, 1 trillion.
Well, see, the
1 trillion.
So the reason why it's very clever is that a UPS generates wall voltage, and then you've got your power supply computer taking that wall voltage and going back down to 12 volts, which mm-hmm. is, you actually need to think a 12 volt main and then a 5 as well. So what they're doing is they're taking that storage, that translation level, which is actually kind of power wasteful, and just putting the 12 volt battery on the inside of the after the power supply.
Yeah.
It's a very clever way of doing it.
And apparently the conversions from 12-volt power are taking place on the motherboard as opposed
right.
to, yeah.
Yeah, just like,
so,
yeah.
Just directly.
All right.
So, yeah, pretty interesting story. We've kind
Thank
of been
you.
Waiting to figure out how Google is doing this. Yeah, and they've got,
they're
I don't know.
Smart. Let's
they're
go on to the next story. Miles, you kind of got something about servers and such, too. Right?
Yes, a data center in Texas, Dallas, Texas, to be exact, was raided by the FBI due to the movie Wolverine, the upcoming movie Wolverine being leaked
mm-hmm.
To peer-to-peer networks. And so the leak has gotten a fair amount of press, but not the results of it. Now, this data center, this is where you would have your server like for co-location or someone hosting for you. This data center was taken down completely. Every customer, everyone... as the FBI came in to try to investigate this, which means that every customer of that data center is offline. In fact, customers went there trying to get their servers, and the FBI threatened them with arrest if they tried to get their servers back.
And under what reasoning?
Because the what they had done is they had tracked the copy of Wolverine to a particular company, that was said to have shared it. And they were mapped to a particular IP, except that that company is no longer a customer of the data center. So a former customer did something that they didn't like. They went after the data center and shut down everyone associated with that data center, which included some phone companies.
Hmm. I think that's a good thing that that happened, because the idea that the FBI is doing this is kind of ridiculous. And that's such a big mess up, they're going to get a lot of flack for it, and they're going to change their policy.
Except that it's not getting that much press.
Okay, so where is it, and who got affected?
Where is the data center?
Yeah.
Dallas, Texas.
Okay, and what companies got affected by it? Aren't those companies upset?
I will have to look. The raid...
This is just because
this
someone leaked
the
movie.
Listed here, the raid impacted probably somewhere around 50 businesses, and that includes AT&T and Google.
Wow. And they're not getting flagged for it. When did this happen?
This happened... the news story is posted April 3rd. So I
did
don't
they
know.
That was surround the building with machine guns or anything? And
actually, the head of the data center is claiming that FBI agents armed were surrounding his house. And when they called him up saying, "You're hiding in your house," his statement, according to him, was that saying, "I'm not even at my house. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona right now. Like, you can't hide from us. We're going to send the dogs on you."
What? What is... Is this a real story? Was this April 1st or April
3rd? No, this is not April... This is not an April Fool's joke.
That's depressing, is it? Thank you.
But it's along the lines of there's a disconnect between technology and how technology works and the implications of that and how legal...
The reason why this is so ridiculous for us is that if one customer in a data center is doing something improper, that's equivalent of a person at a shopping center doing something improper, right? You don't shut down and arrest everyone at the shopping center. You arrest the person that's stealing stuff.
Or it would be more along the lines of an employee at a particular shop was doing something, but the employee doesn't work there anymore, and so you take down the mall to investigate.
Right.
Just drop your data centers on the ground, come out with your hands up.
That's most customers found out about it because they got an email saying that the data center, the power was off.
And that's not really what was happening. Well, thank you very much for that. Let's see. Let's do soft keyboards.
Oh, yeah. This is something I could use right now.
Are you tired?
Well, I've been working on this project, and it's got me up every single night until like 1 a.m. And just kind of browsing the web. And there's this keyboard that these Russian guys... It's actually a Russian site, but you can use the translator for it. And they built a keyboard into a pillow. It's like a flexible keyboard. So, like, you could be, typing on it. You know, it's a pillow. I think they kind of show a picture of a guy who, like, fell asleep at his desk. I had to check this a bunch of times because, it is around April 1st. But it's real. And I did go through the translator to figure it all out and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's a real QWERTY keyboard. And, you can just... type on it. It's soft.
Is that something you would want? I mean, the one thing that would be kind of nice, if you do have it around the couch area and stuff, you can use it, but you can also throw it around. It's not going to hurt. It's gonna be good for like a media center kind of thing.
Or if you're working at your desk and it's like really late and you're like, oh man, I just need the rest for just a...
Actually fallen asleep on the keyboard? I actually have fallen asleep on the keyboard. Well, and then
I was
going to
ask you
face.
About that, that waffle pattern
that's
in your
why,
head.
That's why my face looks the way it does. Wow. But, I have a great face for radio, so that's always nice. Let's go on. Ben?
Oh, yeah. So I just want to really quickly cover tethering. So tethering is when you take your computer and you connect it to your phone, and you use your phone's data connection as an internet connection for your computer. So in other words, you get wireless internet wherever you go on your computer, right? That's really powerful. But that means you're using up a lot of bandwidth. Well, there have been tethering applications you've been able to install on jailbroken iPhones. There have been tethering applications you can install on the Android phones. Well, not really much anymore. I mean, there's still ways to do it, but the Android phones, they're throwing away tethering applications from the online store. So, and then AT&T also recently yesterday, changed its terms of service to limit that kind of use of the plan. So, I don't know, tethering's kind of going, it's on its way out. You know, they're kind of catching on to the fact that if everyone used tethering, their networks would just be crippled. It would be completely unable to.
Their present day networks, as opposed
present
to
day networks, yeah,
right. Building it out. And
I'm always kind of amazed with this because, like, Sprint offers pretty inexpensive data, and they kind of say like unlimited for personal use kind of thing. And they're not; they don't seem to be saying we really are going to break this model. Doesn't really work.
Mm. Oh, I should actually correct myself. I just realized I misspoke. AT&T changed its terms of service to say that tethering is not allowed in plans that were not specifically designed for tethering. So that's
right.
That's specifically what the terms of service said. So,
okay, that's good. That's good to know. I mean, yeah. I'm assuming they have a price point that works for that. Okay, Miles. What's going on with Conflicker? It's been like
Conflicker.
This virus that supposedly was going to wreak havoc on April 1st. I didn't hear a lot about it.
That's the thing. It did, but it was very unnoticeable. It wasn't like the end of the world. And for everyone who did go out and try to do something about it, check the Microsoft site, see whether they can see it, thank you so much. At the same time, it didn't do anything like cause ATMs to start spitting out money or...
We didn't think that was really going to happen, but...
Right. Or it didn't cause anything like Code Red, which was a whole lot of...
Pain for a lot of people.
A whole lot of pain for a lot of people.
So what did it do?
What it did do is update itself to be more insidious. Before, what Conficker did was it would have a set of DNS entries that were dynamically generated, 500 a day, or 250 a day, I'm sorry, 250 per day, so that it was really hard to keep up. Someone just out there could register one of those DNS domain names, or domain names through DNS, sorry, and then the worms en masse would be able to know where to go to get more and more instructions.
Okay.
What happened on April 1st was all these machines went out to do that lookup, and new code was downloaded so that it was no longer 250 DNS, dynamic DNS entries. It's 50,000. With 250, security researchers could register 250 DNS entries and then be able to say, like, okay, we've got this covered, and we can... It was a pain, but they could still do it. 50,000?
Not so much.
Really not... Something
so
that they can catch
this,
up
this
with,
basic idea around these things is if you've got some beast on your local machine and you can really dissect what it's going to do, you can figure out how to stop it from doing that. And one of the things you do is you say, well, this machine will only go look at these locations. This is one of the things to do updates to actually be more devious because it can update itself. So what we're saying is that the way we were looking at it before April 1st, that virus or that application local machine had about 250 of these places it could look at whim and or it'd scan through and look for a specific thing, whatever. And it updated it to how many?
50,000
of these per day. So now it's really easy for someone else out there to communicate with this thing.
Right. If you are in control of the botnet, you register a domain, and then all the machines come to that, and you push out more information. Some ways of doing it. So what it's showing is that the folks who are making this virus, this worm, are not. They're not people that are just fly by night, do something real quick, try to get as many machines as possible. They're very patient, and they are trying to get as many machines as possible that they can use a year from now.
Right.
Or, you know.
Right. It's kind of a threat, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it is. It actually is a part of computing that people do need to think about more, that security aspect. So it is about keeping your antivirus software up to date at all times.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery, showroom offering artisan coffees, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317 Potero Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.greatinfusions.com.
It's a love-hate relationship. Love your cars, hate it when they break. You'll love the car guys and hate to miss them when Click and Clack give their advice on things automotive every Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday morning at 9, right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
The Museum of Art and History Assemblage Collage Construction event continues in April with exhibits at Santa Cruz Mountains Art Center, the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, Cabrillo Gallery, branches of the Santa Cruz County Bank, as well as other venues. Find more information about this countywide series at accsantacruz.org.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Whole Foods Market, featuring products of over 100 Santa Cruz area producers, free of pesticides, preservatives, antibiotics, and hormones. Whole Foods Market Santa Cruz is now open on SoCal Avenue between Branson 40 and Seabright.
You're listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have geeks Miles Elam, Al Luckow, and Ben Jaffe. We are now joined by our guest. Hi, geeks, by the way. Sorry.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning. We're now joined by Mark Christensen. He's an artist, animator, and author. His most recent book, After Effects CS4, Visual Effects and Compositing Studio Techniques, covers color correction, keying, retrospecting, motion tracking, and much more in Adobe After Effects CS4. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
So you came down from San Francisco to enjoy Santa Cruz and hang out with us, geek out a little bit?
That's right. All right. Take the kids to the boardwalk. It's opening day.
Yeah. I might have to tag along for that with my kids.
That is so I heard.
So we all know about video effects that are clear to see. You know, the Titanic breaking apart and falling into the water. We know that that didn't actually happen. And we know that Gollum is an animated character. That's an effect. And we see those kind of things all the time where people are really conscious of them. But there's another level of effects that we're not even really aware of them unless you're kind of in the industry and seeing how people do things. How pervasive are those effects?
Becoming more and more pervasive all the time. I mean, at this point, there are whole movies that legitimately would qualify for an Oscar that have a lot of subtle, fairly invisible work. And in fact, I could even cite The Dark Knight as a movie that had some big spectacle effects in it, you know, although many of those were not done digitally, you know, like flipping a truck over in the middle of the loop.
That was actually done with a cable and...
They flipped that truck over.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
I'm talking about the most recent Batman movie.
Yeah.
What are the video effects that are subtle in that we don't see?
Well, that film, but I mean, that's not even necessarily the best example.
Okay.
But to step back for a second, almost anything you see nowadays has some intermediation between what was taken with the camera and what you actually see. And at the most basic level, there's more and more just heavy manipulation of color going on. So if you look at a lot of episodic television now, it tends to have very strong color choices compared to what you would have seen even, you know, 10 years ago or beyond. There were shows 10 years ago that were doing that, like The X-Files, but...
You're talking about kind of like a dynamic color range, if you
will? Well, you know, if you notice, I mean, look at a scene
Let's talk about an actual show. Yeah.
Well, all right. Gosh.
Well, The Matrix is a good example, because when you're in The Matrix, you kind of have this greenish tint almost.
The
like
Matrix is a classic example, but I would say to anyone watching this, I mean, look at an episode of CSI or look at one of those type of shows... So not so much the kind of sitcom-y kind of shows, but dramatic television will tend to have scenes. And if you step back and look at it, it may only have one color dominant. Like it might be predominantly blue or it might be predominantly amber. You look at a movie like Traffic and it actually used color that way to even tell you where you were and which story thread you were following. So Steven Soderbergh and his DP and colorist on that movie went with, you know, very specific color as a leitmotif for different storylines in that movie.
And all those color choices are actually post?
Yeah, absolutely.
So not lighting the scene bluish, they're just modifying later.
Right. I mean, okay, there's been a...
Sorry. I was thinking of Traffic because it's come up in a film class I had recently. Mm-hmm. The very blue if you were in the Washington area or the New England area, and a very washed out yellow for Mexico. Bleached, sun-bleached color.
Right. And emotionally, it's partly to tell you where you are, but there's an emotional response to it, too. I mean, the blue cool color tells you you're in wealthy, you know, Southern California, and it goes yellow, and Mexico and Southern California really actually have very similar landscapes, but all of a sudden, and you know, you're... Yeah.
How are these things, how are the colors applied? I mean, what's going on? What's going on behind the scenes?
Well, the first film... And it's interesting that you introduced me as a video artist. Because No, that's good. I mean, that's fine and it's accurate. But we're in the similar period as when, remember Tower Records, and they were selling all CDs back in, you know, back in the day. Like, it's a similar kind of, you know, we're looking for what to really call this stuff in the 21st century. And that argument pervades other topics as well that we'll maybe get to. But... I'm sorry, the question again.
It's blue. Okay, so they put a blue filter. You're doing it in a program?
I was going to say that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was the first film to get a full DI. So the whole film went through a color system. The high-end system, or the one that's most commonly used on films right now, is called a Da Vinci. And it's basically a process of taking... If the movie was shot on film, it actually all has to be digitized, run through this. There's a colorist who does work not only on the overall color of the scene, but they'll do, it's called different things in different applications, but they'll do maybe what's called power windows, where they'll actually take a face, maybe light it up. If it's like a scene of wonder, you might actually bloom somebody's face up. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a good colorist is keeping a fairly light touch. And that's why I'm challenging your listening audience now to go just watch something ordinary, but step back for a second and just like take a look at what color it is versus even, you know, the room you're sitting in or a photo you would take yourself.
And so like a dramatic television series is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
If you'll start watching and say, well, what's the color of the scene? You'll see that they're changing it all the time.
Yeah, and just about any feature film you see over the last decade, I mean, you're going to see what's interesting about things that we call cinematic is they have fewer things in them than things in life. So... a cinematic frame rate is fewer frames, and a cinematic scene has fewer colors. Actually, if you look, there are exceptions. I mean, Speed Racer had every color and some I'd never even seen before in it. But most, and that was, they were going for kind of an op art style. But most films, actually, if you look at a typical film scene, it might have three colors in the frame. And if you put a fourth one in there, it would look less cinematic. It would start to take away that quality.
Yeah, in your book you talk a lot about perception and the differences between our vision and realism and the camera and cinema. So maybe
right.
we can talk about that.
Well, the art of what I'm explaining in the book, which is compositing in the film process, is usually the last person to touch a shot other than the colorist before it is seen. And sometimes sometimes the compositor is also the colorist, but the compositor is the one assembling the shot, and really, in sometimes a kind of painterly way and in sometimes a much more technical way, just making it look right. So when people ask me what I do, I say, well, you know, if you can imagine an actor flying or something, you know, before that shot was assembled, you had somebody with some cables and rigging and on a green, and, you know, if I showed you the shot before I put it together, you'd say, well, that doesn't look like anything at all.
Or, dude, I meant like when Batman jumps across a roof or something, it's actually a human can't do that.
Really, right. It's the process of taking disparate elements, some of which may have been created on a computer, some of which may have been shot at different times, and putting them together. And that process is becoming more common, as is the process of removing things that were in the frame, and at all levels, that's becoming more common to do that.
And so, video makers or filmmakers are shooting the entire time and thinking in that way.
Yeah, and what I was going to say about the process is it's not so much a process of making it look real, although that's what everybody obsesses about, but making it look cinematically real. So really matching the truth of what the camera would see. So knowing how the camera looks at the world becomes a really important thing to be able to do this kind of work. And it's the technical part of it that I actually kind of enjoy.
And as far as
let's get geeky a bit.
Okay,
okay.
Yeah.
I think it's time. Yeah.
Geeky. what kind of resolutions do you work at when you're compositing video? Like, I know the standard definition is like 720 by 480.
Right.
It's like a DVD.
Yeah.
But what's film?
Well, yeah, a movie is what's called 2K, generally. 2048 is a film width. And
that's a vertical resolution?
That's horizontal. And when we talk about television, those numbers are usually thrown out vertically for some reason. So they'll talk about 1080. But that's actually all nearly the same. That's a 1920 pixel. And we're talking about pixels here, right. Pixel wide. Those pixels with your HDTV will be translated directly as pixels on your monitor. In a film, you know, they'll go to film. So what you're looking for with a film is just to get the right resolution so that
you're effectively, since we talk more about HD types on this show because we're talking about computer screens mm-hmm. and stuff,
yeah.
you're effectively talking about 1080p is what you actually edit in.
It's very close to that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
a little larger,
really similar. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, there are cameras now that are capable of shooting 4K. That typically is used for effects work when you want to reframe or you want to otherwise right. use the footage in some other way than just framed exactly as it was shot. But,
right.
you know, generally you wouldn't.
Having a little flexibility.
Right. I mean, some people, I think, are making the mistake now as these 4K cameras become more accessible of staying in 4K because they think they're going to get better quality in the end. But if in the end you're just kind of going to shrink it down to something people can actually watch. I mean, right now we don't have very many means of displaying an image that big. And that's one of the areas where things have gone up. You know, it's just like megapixels on a camera.
Sure.
But another area that is one I find really interesting is frame rate. There are new HDTVs that you would buy now that do what's called 120 hertz or 120 frames a second. And what they're actually doing is interpolating. So they're taking an old films from time immemorial, and by time immemorial I mean since sound came in the late 20s, have been displayed at 24 frames a second. And your eye can resolve about, there's some debate about this, but your television does 60 interlaced fields a second, and that's pretty close to what your eye does. And I think there's some debate about this, and I think some people can develop their, you know, we're talking about your nervous system and the pulse of you know, your optic nerve. So,
well, and I want to get into that a little bit, but
yeah.
When you say your TV does 60 frames interlaced, if you have an old CRT TV,
yeah,
most
I'm talking
at this point don't actually.
Well, but even your HD TV is still
doing that.
Yeah, if you're watching the news or what have you, it's still on that standard. If you're watching a movie on TV, it's been interpolated to kind of work in that format. And what those 120 frame per second, the reason they chose 120 is that number multiplies evenly. 60 goes into 120, 24 goes into 120. So what they can do is, with all of those formats, make them even smoother. Like, you know, on the fly, they're smoothifying all your video. And the idea is that that's what you want.
Did you just say smoothifying?
Yeah, I like to make up. Yeah.
You heard it here first.
They're embiggening the frame rate.
So when they smoothify the frame rate, is that the look? That's not the look of cinema.
No, and I there are those of us who consider it a little bit evil, because what I was saying about removing things to make something cinematic applies to frame rate as well. Now, there's a big debate about this. I mean, I'm going to say I'm right, but I'm going to hear the other side, and the other side says, well, you know, it's the 21st century now, buddy, and the reason we ended up with 24 was actually because Hollywood studios were too cheap
right.
to go for
to
a higher frame rate.
Pictures,
they
yeah.
actually were going, what they were trying to do is find the lowest frame rate that people would accept so they could save money
right.
on film.
Right.
And which is interesting, but...
Well, and I would say that it's not just that, because we're talking about mechanical means at that time. It's actually really hard to go that fast in sync. Oh, they could do it.
They were able to do it. Yeah, no, it was a money decision. Okay. It's interesting.
I guess it always is.
Yeah, well, but here's what happened later on. A favorite example of mine is in the early days of television. You guys might know the Twilight Zone, the original.
Sure.
Yeah, any geek should know the Twilight Zone. And those were predominantly shot on film at 24 frames a second. Now, there were a few episodes, and I cite these in the book because it's one of my favorite examples, and it's only because I love the show. I love the quality of the show, kind of film noirish kind of quality yeah. that show had. There were episodes they did that for a little while they experimented with shooting on tape. So they did videotape. And there are only, you know, five or six episodes from the second and third season. I think it was all in the second season because they abandoned it really fast. It was easier for them to shoot this way. But if you watch these episodes, it's the most bizarre thing, because it suddenly goes from being like the ironic and mystical Twilight Zone to being kind of like a cheap soap opera. Like, all of a sudden, it seems much more histrionic and much more cornball. Soap operas and reality TV are 60i. Anything that should feel immediate and live and like we're following OJ as he's driving down the freeway in slow motion, that is meant to feel really immediate.
So 60i, what's i?
Interlace. So 60 interlace fields, because that was a compromise. That was a technical compromise back in the 50s, was they could do 30 frames a second, and then to do better than that and not have it look all flickery, what they did was actually interlace every other line. We're not talking about pixels at this point. We're just talking about a raster image that just was basically doing an even set and then an odd set in quick succession.
This whole frame thing is really fascinating with how the eye works, because we don't actually see black. That's an absence of light. And so if you flicker your environment, stripe it, whatever, with black, you basically just fade it darker a little bit. And that's the effect that happens if you do it small enough and fast enough. So when you see this interlace, you don't actually see that there's an interlace going on, because the lines that are not on, you don't see.
Well, if you do see it, you'll give you a headache. And it's kind of similar to if you have an old CRT monitor and you don't set it at a high enough refresh rate, I mean, that can really make you nauseated. And if you travel to a country that has PAL television, like the UK, you might notice it. I certainly do when I'm there. Well, they have a slightly slower. They standardize to 25 frames a second,
right,
and they do still interlace, but it's just enough slower.
But their color is better.
Yeah, and I mean, people do obsess over things like that as well.
NTSC, which is the standard in the United States, is an acronym of never the same.
Never color. The same color. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, but it's not fading to black, though. I mean, a lot of times, especially when you had the older TVs, one of the reasons why it worked so well, the interlacing, is because you had the ghosting.
They keep glowing.
It had that persistence in
there. And what you're talking about is the way the CRT works, is there's actually phosphorescence in there, and you're igniting that with the X-ray, and it actually lights up.
Here's a geek irony. In the 50s, they standardized not to 60, but actually the accurate way to say it would have been 59.94.
Why?
Well, there was a little technical problem with the TVs that were already out there. The very oldest black and white televisions couldn't do exactly 30. They had this, it was just an engineering problem. It was basically like people would have had to throw away their TVs.
Why we have 29.97?
And we still have it. And the most horrifying thing is we still have it in HD, which is like, you would have thought at some point we could cut the cord and just move on. But it's so difficult. There's really no clean way to make that break, you know, because
what about all the smarts that are in these HD TVs? I'm assuming that they are biases and we could update them at some point. So isn't it possible that the hardware could compensate at some point?
Well, then that's what I'm saying. That's what these 120 TVs are doing. You know, they're taking everything that is a divisor of 120 and going, yeah, well, we're going to make them 120 now. So yeah, at this point, that's true. And isn't it typical that technology always manages 5 years later to solve the problem that everybody was fussing over? But, you know, I mean, how ironic is it now that they couldn't just make a lot of people just throw away their damn TV? I mean, that was a very small loss in retrospect for the number of man hours that have been spent puzzling over that bizarre.
It was probably less than 50,000 TVs, too.
That's kind of like conversion from metric to, or like to metric in the United States. Maybe if we had done it 80 years ago, it would have not been that big of a deal. But now it just would be god awful. Yeah,
well, that's another show. I think we could do it.
I've tried.
We could do it, but people don't want to. They're lazy.
It was tried a little over 30 years ago.
As part of the Reagan Revolution to blow that right away.
Yeah, that's what you see. Kilometers on signs in really small print.
They're all from the late 70s.
That was Carter.
Yeah, it was a Carter.
They're all the rusting signs.
If you can't tell, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. This is KOSP, the Air Room with me, Al Luckow, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and our guest, Mark Christensen, the author of a trainer and author and teacher of Adobe After Effects. And we're talking about video in general. Would you consider yourself an artist?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I work as an artist. I mean, to say I'm a trainer and teacher of software is actually the one where I kind of squirm a little bit, because I try to transcend the software a little bit. I did write the book as an After Effects book because the other books out on the topic were really geeky and very high level, the problem with that is you never get down to telling somebody, here's how you actually do it. And I'm not talking about here's the menu where the command is. I'm talking here's how you get in there and actually make fire look like it is burning in that scene.
Why is it that sometimes an item that's placed in, like in your book, you use a Red Bull can quite a bit. Sometimes it looks like it's been placed in and sometimes it doesn't seem like it is. And that all has to do with the complexity of color and balance. Yeah.
That's one of the things I like about the book, is that you don't spend those extra pages saying this is where the menu item is. It's not a beginner's book. it's an intermediate and advanced book.
Right.
And so if you want to learn where all the menu items are, you can, you know, consult the After Effects literature. You can buy another book. But, you know, I feel like it's very dense with content. So.
Yeah. I mean, I used After Effects from, like, version 2. When it was COSA, and it was it wasn't an Adobe product at that time, and you know, at the time it was the one thing you could use on a just a, you know, regular old beige Mac to make visual effects, to do compositing. When I started I didn't even know the word compositing. I just started doing this stuff, and you could do some good, I mean, it was also good with keyframe animating, so you could match stuff in there.
Yeah, it's amazing seeing you do stuff in video, like you know, doing a green screen, releasing the chroma keying, pulling the stuff out of it, because I'll do that in stills quite commonly.
Yeah.
And it's time consuming and very laboratory, and then I see you do it and I realize, yeah, you're doing it at a completely different level, because of course you're not doing it frame by frame. You're producing a video output that's going to chroma key well. So you've got to really know the settings to do
well,
that.
Well, you know, I mean, a couple things about that. There are much better selection tools in Photoshop than there are in After Effects, because there's a lot more you can get away with in terms of how you select something with a still. As soon as you have to put it in motion, it has to hold up over time.
Right.
That is one area that a lot of work is being done now to solve that problem of making things consistent over time, when you have to fight in a physical image, you have to fight against optics, you have to fight against compression grain. Mm-hmm. I mean, even with a digital image, as anybody knows who's gone in and studied particularly the blue channel, if you ever really want to see where all the garbage is, go look at the blue channel. That's a good measure of how good your camera sensor is. And if you go in there, you know, there's a lot of junk in there, and it changes from frame to frame. I mean, the grain structure, and grain is our friend as compositors, so it's been harder on actors and on visual effects people to be in a cleaner and cleaner signal, because it was something that was confronted, I think, first on Phantom Menace, Star Wars 1, where they shot, the model shop did a lot of things like they would have always done in terms of the level of detail that they put in things, but they started shooting stuff digitally and noticing that it wasn't holding up
as well. It didn't look like it was big, because it didn't have grain small enough, kind of thing.
You know, and then I think there's a guy who has a blog about actors that don't hold up as well these days. And of course, I've heard the pornography industry is horrified by HD.
Yeah, how do they do that? And that's the thing, is it's not just that it's more resolution, if you will, it's that the actual capture medium is more perfect.
Yeah, there's a clarity, there's a lack of I mean, film grain is kind of, it sort of has a nice aesthetic in a way. I mean, we don't mind it entirely, but again, it's like I mean, me saying that is like me saying I like 24 frames a second too. I mean, there's the opposite school is like, no, it's evil, get rid of it, it's it's so from the past. It's like saying the vinyl albums are better than CDs.
But they are.
Of course.
So geeks run in both directions on these issues.
How big are these files, these 2K and 4K uncompressed files? I just bought a new 500 gig hard drive and, you know, velcroed it to the back of my Mac.
Nice.
But I mean, that wouldn't hold all that much 2K or 4K uncompressed video.
Yeah, we seem to manage to keep coming up with formats that basically blow right past our convenient technology. I mean, the computer you have right now in front of you, I would have, if you'd handed me that computer even, you know, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago to do my real work that I was doing at a workstation, I would have been thrilled. And when I think about 10 years ago working on the allegedly fast SGI 10K machines, I mean, I think my iPhone could, at this point, outperform that machine. So
SGI, rest in peace.
Yes, exactly. I think
SGI 10K
Miles is
very
P2 over there.
The graphics card was what it was all about in those SGI machines. That's where they got everybody. But, how big are the frames? It depends on the amount of compression in them. I know with the Red camera, it does 30:1 compression right on the sensor. You can't get past it. And you still are looking at, I mean, for, say, a typical 30-second shot, you're looking at like half a gig of...
So what kind of drives do you use then? I mean, are you using a RAID system? Or, I mean, how can you manage...
Yeah, it helps to have a RAID for sure.
What exactly are you using? Just...
Well, usually a striped RAID with, I mean, if you're talking about a typical, like, SATA RAID, then it's good to have, I think 60, and I'm going to probably screw this up, but I think it's 60 megabit per second, or is it megabyte? I'm not sure, but those drives have with a, say, 16 meg memory in them, they can usually sustain that, and then if you've got I found if you have three of those, which is if you have a Mac Pro, you've got four bays in it, so you need one for your startup drive, and then with three of them in the other drives, you can stripe those. That will play back HD, even uncompressed, pretty well, but it's borderline. If you really want to reliably do it, you want to over-engineer and go to four, which gives you 300 mega.
So how much space are we talking here? I mean, what is it like?
Sorry, go on.
Yeah.
What? I'm just laughing because I tuned out to do some station business for a second. And I turned around, you guys were geeking out, and I wasn't in the beginning of it. So I felt like most of our audience.
But what are they talking about? Well, how much space? I mean, do you have like 10 terabytes? Or, I mean, what kind of typically are you using in your RAID system?
I mean? Yeah.
There's always this question is.
You don't want to tell us, do you?
No. It's a moving target, it's just the kind of thing where it's less than you would think often at a big facility, and yet it's just, I mean, depend, you know, I mean, if we're talking about a facility like ILM that's been around for a long time and has a huge archive, then you're talking about hundreds.
Well, what about you? Typically terabytes. For a project, I mean, you have like a 2 terabyte RAID system, and that sort of does it for you for the...
Usually does it, and then I've got a Drobo, so I tend to back stuff up to that. So the reason I hesitated to ask is there's an element of laziness that creeps in where I tend to be a little bit minimalist, so I like to be a little lean and mean
so
with
you
my
delete stuff.
Yeah, I do like, and I like tools that help me intelligently do that. It's similar to using After Effects actually to do your work. Like, you can do it in a kind of leaner system than a lot of what's out there, you know, turnkey systems to do.
I'm sure that's encouraging for a lot of people to hear.
Yeah.
A lot of people think, I can't do this because I just don't have that kind of... But as a professional in the field, you can say that, actually, don't let that stop you.
Well, drive space is cheap these days, and it's actually wise if people have footage sitting on tape to... In fact, I need to do this with a lot of my old home movies and get it transferred because that stuff wears out, we're finding.
It's true. You can learn a lot more about Mark Christensen on his site, Christensen.com. Of course, go to geekspeak.org to learn more as well. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at kosp.org. Coming up next is Car Talk. And I want to mention that Car Talk on KOSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County. We appreciate their support. We also appreciate the geeks coming in today, Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Al Luckow. Thank you, geeks, very much.
Always a pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Our guest today, Mark Christensen, does a lot of authoring and a lot of work. You've seen some of his. You want to name some of the credits you've been involved with quickly?
Oh, like feature films is what it's all about. It's Pirates of the Caribbean 3, Day After Tomorrow, and some of those Robert Rodriguez 3D movies for kids.
You can get a great older reel of his up on his site, Christensen.com. And, of course, you can ask us questions throughout the week on our forums at geekspeak.org. And, of course, contact us directly. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.